Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big. Pop. Fun.
It's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast dedicated to pop culture and the lives that live within its gentle influence. Or tightening grasp. Or soul-crushing evil claws. Depending on who you are. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. It's me, Tom Wilson. The lovely and talented, if you really have very low standards, host of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. You are on my podcast, and welcome. It's a magical sleigh ride of wonder and enchantment and entertainment and delight that leads us across the little cottage tops that are in all of Thomas Kincaid's paintings, but since now he's passed away, so probably his family is going to sue us for even mentioning them, because really, it's always the estate of the person that kind of goes crazy, isn't it? At the end, I'm sure that if Thomas Kincaid were alive, he would allow us to, in our imaginations, travel in our magical entertainment sleigh ride over the little thatched cottages that imbued his paintings with wonder and love and a warmth that we hope he's experiencing now. I think that was the worst one of all time, really, wasn't it? I try to improvise my little things of wonderland and enchantment or excitement or entertainment. And okay, so fail on that one. This is brought to you by TomWilsonUSA.com. It's my website. I'm traveling all around this great land of ours and any English-speaking countries doing shows, so look me up there. You can contact me. Thanks so much, everybody, for contacting me, for emailing me through the website and say that you're listening. I appreciate that. And it's, as always, it's brought to you by art. Go out and buy something. Buy a piece. This summer, go out and go to an art fair and look at a little tiny – it can be 4 inches by 4 inches, a tiny painting. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but you put it in your kitchen and you just say, that is a thing that one afternoon in the summertime I liked. So I bought it from a real human being, and it was made with human hands and a human thing before the cyborgs take over and are immediately sued by Thomas Kincaid's estate. Although, well, never mind. Let's not go there. You know, in the late 70s, I had seen Star Wars. I saw the movie, and it was good. Good space movie, whatever. I was a young guy. I was thinking about becoming an actor. I was just starting that process of going to acting classes and everything. But then at a couple of years, I started really auditioning and being the savior of the American theater as we know it, really studying and taking it seriously and reading the books and going to the classes. And I was in summer Shakespeare, summer stock Shakespeare roles, you know, Richard III, Henry IV, Part One. And there weren't any good parts. I called myself generally a stage balancing unit. And at one play I was in, I actually tried to have them put, you know, they'll put the role under you where it would say Tom Wilson, Lord Mayor of London, this guy, that guy, and I wanted them to say stage balancing unit, but they wouldn't put it up there because basically I was given small roles, and I would come to the back of the stage and say, you know, my lord, the Guildfords are in arms, every day their power increaseth, something like that. I don't know. There was some attack coming, and I would announce the attack. But then the director would have said, well, Tom, stay there. Stay on stage. Because I was very useful, because I was a very big kid. So they could put like a giant kind of maroon-colored carpeting thing on me and strap it around as if I was a soldier of some kind. And then as the actors were acting downstage near the audience, the great Shakespearean play, I was upstage, which is toward the back of the stage. And as actors would move on the stage, they would say, and Tom, why don't you counter stage left? Which means as those three people are moving with their plot or something, and they're moving down and they're moving to the audience's left, then I am sort of pretending to listen, but I'm moving across to the right so that the stage looks balanced. And with something that had some color to it and being large, I could maybe take up the visual space of three people. So they would just go, yes, this guy, Richard, and you, stage right, and Tom in the back there, counter. So most of the work that I was doing was as a stage balancing unit. But I was a serious and dedicated stage balancing unit. Frustrated, of course, because I really didn't get any decent roles, just kind of stage balancing unit and small roles. But I didn't give up. I was going to be the savior of the American theater. I moved to New York City. I was going to acting schools, none of which I want to tell you because I don't want to accidentally give them a commercial because really it was a waste of time and money. But I did pretend to be very seriously studying acting with a lot of people who had actually never gotten acting jobs and didn't know what they were talking about. But when I lived in New York, auditioning for plays all over the place and not getting cast in anything, maybe I should have listened to the acting classes better. In my opinion, I should have actually listened to them less and I would have worked faster. But I was living in New York and The Empire Strikes Back was released. Now this, as we know, these kind of false manufactured cultural phenomena when sequels come out for these big, you know, computer-aided robot movies or whatever, it's impossible to communicate how huge the opening of a movie like The Empire Strikes Back was at that time. The kind of special effects that were in that movie were unheard of. So, like I said, hey, Star Wars was good. I wasn't a, you know, I didn't buy my lightsaber or whatever immediately. But hey, good movie. And The Empire Strikes Back was a cultural phenomena. And I was in New York City and I had nothing to do that day. So a friend of mine and I really got in line 8 hours before the movie just to see it the first night of The Empire Strikes Back. Yeah. We stood there and we bought pizza slices and everything. And we just stood there with a lot of, you know, it was actually movie fans. It wasn't, you know, no one was in the Empire, whatever they are called, the Jedi costumes, whatever I don't know. You know, the white things with the looks like a hair dryer's on the guy's head. Well, whatever. There was no one dressed up like that because that hadn't actually happened yet. It was just a bunch of people who were going to see The Empire Strikes Back. And we watched the movie and the special effects just at that time for that, the space shots, the fighter planes going through space, going, and it was, and the audience in the theater, everyone's going, whoa! Like they'd never seen anything like that before. They were actually verbally reacting just to special effects. Wow! How did I do that? How did they do that? So it comes to the point, of course, where Darth Vader turns and says, Luke, I am your father. This was the first night. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. There was no nothing. The first night of its release, he says, Luke, I am your father. The entire audience gasps like, oh, like that. Everybody. I remember it to this day, how incredible it was to be able to surprise an audience like that. And everyone's walking, staggering out of the theater. What? Darth Vader is his father? It's unbelievable. But I swear to you, I came out of the theater that night thinking, how did that Luke Skywalker guy get that gig? Look, he's a good-looking kid and everything, but look at me. I mean, here I am. I'm in New York. I'm studying at all the places you're supposed to be studying. I'm doing all the things you're supposed to be doing, auditioning unsuccessfully for, you know, Titus Andronicus and eating top ramen every day. What? How do you get in movies? Who is this guy? Mark Hamill? Who is this guy? How do you do that? I could do that because, you know, I was crazy and I was having to face the fact that this trail of introspection in New York City that led to the dashed dreams of that, you know, the dream of becoming the savior of the American theater and being cast in Titus Andronicus and people sit, because most of that early acting stuff, most of acting now is not actually doing the work. It's, wow, I wonder how I will be thought of by other people by doing this particular work. And fortunately, I hope, to a great degree, I think I've, taken what, very, very shower with bleach or whatever to get over that thing. But, so much of acting is, how will I be seen? What will I seem like to people? And what will people think of me? Which is why you're going around auditioning for Titus Andronicus and Richard III. So people go, oh, he's a serious actor. I was thinking, yeah, I'm a serious actor, but look at that guy. He's in a cool movie with fighter things going around in space. And so anyway, that period of my life led, as I've talked about in interviews and stuff, to a series of, U-turns and intersections and heartbreak and defeat, which led ultimately to the great thing, ultimately to stand-up comedy clubs, to the improv there in New York, to the comic strip, to stand-up comedy stages, and finally to here in Los Angeles, where I would meet and work with and befriend the very talented and affable and funny and sharp and sophisticated and really great guy, Mark Hamill himself. Mark's a great guy. And Mark has dealt with this thing that has happened to him with more with more grace and humor than I think 99% of people would. Because try thinking about that, really. I mean, you're a young actor and a thing sort of outside your control happens. And then you're just in a kayak in some big white water. So Mark's a friend. And I told him I'd like to talk to him on my podcast and ask him about his life. And hey, the thing with me is, I don't know if you've listened to a lot of the podcasts, but I told him, be on my podcast and I won't bring up the 800-pound gorilla at all. Because if there's one thing that a guy like Mark and to a far lesser degree, a guy like me can do, if there's one thing we're able to do, it's talk to people while we're standing right next to the 800-pound gorilla, and we don't even bring it up. And people talk to us, and they'll always finally say, hey, well, what about this 800-pound gorilla? I mean, it's standing right there. And we just say, yeah, that's always there. It's no big deal. So we talked for a long time at Mark's house, and I'm going to split them up into parts. But I hope that you enjoy talking about Mark's life with part one with my conversation with Mark Hamill.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Let's put. Can you put move the mic? You don't have to be right on top of it, but a little closer.
How about that?
That's great. Okay. That's great. So, Sushi Girl, you and Jeff Fahey.
Sushi Girl is actually like an ensemble piece of about six actors. And what they did was there were three or four parts that were, really cameos in essence, but they wanted to get all cult movie type people. So Jeff Fahey came in and did one day. He's the guy we rob. Sonny Chiba is in it. He's like one of Jeff Fahey's minions. Who else? Michael Biehn from Aliens came in and did one day for us, which was surprising to me because, you never know how asking people to do cameos is going to do. Hey, Griffin.
Griffin's accepting your FedEx.
He is, and my attack dog is, of course, guarding
the
door.
What's the dog's name?
Ralph. We thought we should give him a real macho sort of name to counteract his poofy appearance.
Yeah, you have a little poofy dog.
He's a Maltipoo, he grew up with our dog that passed away at 17,
mm-hmm.
And she was it was really rough. I mean, I would advise young parents to get an animal. It allows siblings to express love that they can't to each other. And we waited a long time. Nathan was already probably in junior high school when we got Franny, or almost at junior high school. And what I'm saying is we didn't have a family dog from the get-go. On the other hand, when you go to New York to do plays.
Oh, my gosh.
Taking those dogs and the responsibility of getting them out a minimum of three times, usually four times, it's really tough, especially when they go down to the lobby, they look out, and they I don't want to go out in that. Can I just pee right here? Yeah.
Bring me some galoshes and a sweater. I'm not doing it. You do it.
And they're such spoiled little, you know, they're not hardy dogs. You said you had border collies.
Border collies,
that's a real dog.
You couldn't do that in New York City.
Unless they could let them herd cabs. You see these people that have these huge dogs. You figure, how?
You have this little woman who's in her running outfit and everything.
And then she has a small pony on a leash.
Exactly.
It's shocking.
Oh, it's just, you know, Prince, my Irish wolfhound.
The responsibility of, it's like, well, I don't feel like going out either day. You don't have that option. It's not like they have a litter box like a cat. One thing that was funny is that it's such a routine. I would constantly pass Kevin Conway, who's my Batman, and in all the years I've done Joker, he'd be on his rounds with his dog. So it is kind of fun, and it makes you get up and gives you motivation to go out. You know, I take him first thing in the morning, and usually after the play I take him out at 11:30 at night. And in the summertime, it's no problem. They can't wait to go out. This one, by the way, he barked as you arrived. He has no concept of his size or his place in the world. So we're in Central Park. He's barking at horses, okay? The horses are kind of looking around. They don't even see him. Like, you know, what was that, a mosquito?
Yeah, and he's all of, what, 8-10 inches tall?
Yeah, and fierce in his presentation, which really makes me laugh because it's so disproportional to his place in the world. But God love him. I mean, I do love dogs, although Mary Lou is saying this, my wife, she's saying, you know, when Ralph is no longer with us, we're not getting another dog. I feed them, and she just doesn't like the fact that as they get older, they tend to want to relieve themselves in the laundry room. And that makes her crazy. So,
man, ours have wanted to do that for from birth, it seems.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's funny because border collies are much more acclimated to being outdoor dogs.
They really are outdoor dogs. They're very active. They're very smart.
Right.
But apparently, they just want to establish their ownership of the living room.
Yeah, there you go.
They just want to say, I don't care, rub my nose in it, yell at me. I'm just going to come out here and say, this rug is mine.
Yeah. Well, they've ruined enough rugs where she's sort of become adamant against having more.
So this
animals.
Is the dog swan song? This is it?
Well, she says that. You know, who knows? We'll just wait and see. Because, like I say, I mean, it is an imposition if you have to travel 3,000 miles. I mean, it was one of those things where I couldn't consider going back. And, you know, I wouldn't go off and just do a play and leave my family. So even with my daughter, I said, because last time I did a show, she was still in high school, what do you feel about moving? Because I was a Navy brat. My dad was in the Navy, so I went to 9 schools in 12 years.
Oh, really?
And when I was young, it wasn't such a bad deal. I mean, I would miss my friends, but it was kind of an adventure. We're going to go to Pennsylvania or whatever it was. It was always coast to coast to coast because of the Navy thing. But
oh, I thought you were a kind of California guy.
No. I was born here, but I don't remember. The first place I remember being, you know, that I can remember is Virginia. And then we went from Virginia to San Jose to Pittsburgh to San Diego to Virginia. I graduated from Yokohama High in Japan. So, and what I'm saying is as you get older, as you get into junior high school and you start, you know, going to dances and wanting a girlfriend or joining clubs, that's when it gets emotionally hard to say goodbye. In fact, I remember I used to have a technique where, you know, you'd be clearing out your lockers for the summer, and someone would say, well, I guess I won't see you. Oh, no, I'll see you because I'm going to that thing on Saturday. I'll see you there. Lying because I just didn't want to have another one of those lump in your throat moments. And they were constant, you know. So I remember thinking when I got older, I said, when I get married and have children, I will not be in a profession that will uproot people. I'm going to avoid for them what happened to me. And, of course, what happens? You get into show business, you're off to Vancouver for 2 weeks or, you know, wherever we can get a job, that's where we go. So.
Now, were you in plays in high school? I mean, could you be at a place enough to – were you that or were you an athlete or what kind of stuff that you had to quit or leave?
The things I was good at, I did wrestling for one season. I was a good swimmer, but I didn't really – I mean, come on. The swim team was not something I was into. You know, I was too shy to wear those kind of suits in public. But I wasn't good at any of the sports that were like fan favorites. My brother, my older brother, I'm in the middle of seven. I have an older brother, two older sisters, a younger brother, two younger sisters. I'm smack dab in the middle. And Bill was really good at football. He didn't play basketball, but, I mean, he was all around. He was much more athletic than I was. I loved all the stuff that I still love now, which is ironic because I loved puppets, I loved magic, I loved cartoons, I loved movies. I always wanted to be somehow associated with show business without really being sure that I wanted to be an actor. Well, maybe I could be like a – I loved working on sets, painting sets and doing – I loved being around the show. So that was one of those things where then that was one of the things that was hard because once I got into activities, like in Virginia, I finally got into doing plays and being part of that the drama crowd, and all the misfits were, you know, part of that. And that's who I gravitated towards. I mean, I was more at home with misfits than I was with athletes, although I could always make athletes laugh, so that was a good thing, you know, and bullies too. I mean, we took a bus we lived in Yokosuka, but we took an hour bus ride. You know, an hour to school, an hour from school, which is, you know, again, taking
this was Japan.
In Japan. And it was the caste system. All the nerds had to sit in the front of the bus, and the cool guys were in the back. And very early on, I had a self-deprecating sense of humor. I could do voices. I'd do Peter Lorre. I'd do Bela Lugosi and so forth. So I was amusing to the guys that could potentially kill you. And I was eventually taken in as sort of the court jester of the cool kids and the athletes, which was the top of the line, really. One thing that was interesting in the shift from a school in Virginia where it was 2,000 kids to Japan was in Japan it was only 500 kids. So I went to my junior year, and by the time you finished your first year, you knew everybody. Even if you didn't know their exact name, you knew them by their face. And someone said, you know, you ought to run for class president. I said, no. My friend John Richardson, who's the quarterback of the football team, you know, the big dream boat and, you know, the most popular guy in school, is going to run, and it'll probably ruin our relationship. But I thought, you know what? I probably could win if I play, you do my homework. And that's what I did. I read the school rule book, in other words, the whatever they called that official, and I found in the original book of rules, whatever, I can't remember what they refer to it as, that we were entitled to no less than 3 assemblies per month, so 1 a week minus 1 week. And I made that a centerpiece of my speech. Not only was it a funny speech, but and my slogan was, Ham's the man. I should have lost just on that alone. But I had that as the surprise shocker of the – and I said, if I'm elected, I will exercise that, and we will have 3 assemblies per month. So that was kind of a shock to the not only my opponent but to the principal of the school, because he later said, Mark, come on, let's get serious here. I mean, the teachers aren't going to like it. It upsets the flow of their curriculum and so forth. But I said, well, I made it as a promise. So we had – I mean, it wouldn't even matter. We'd have like these Japanese musicians come in and play those – you know, those
playing those traditional Japanese instruments.
Whatever. Or you know, my dad was in retail sales, so we ran the PX and you know, the Officers Club, and you know, so it was a tangentially connected to showbiz. And because I'd go out to the airport and pick up the USO people, I'd always get them to come out. Like, they come to do Wonderful Town at all the bases and so forth. And so I invite them to my school and do like an hour or a 45-minute version, you know, like a Cliff Notes of Wonderful Town. And I did that. I mean, I was true to my word. We wound up doing – I might have missed 2 or 3 tops, especially when teachers would come and say, please, you know, don't do it this week because, you know, it's up, you know, week before finals. So I was flexible. But I won. And it did hurt my relationship with John, but eventually he got over it. I mean, like I say, he was a big football star, and it was just sort of an affront to him because he was the anointed one. He was going to win if I hadn't run. You know, I was sort of Obama to his Hillary. You know, like, wait your turn. Although, I wouldn't have had another turn. And I have to tell you, if I was back in the States, there's no way I would have won against, like, you know, the people that ran for those kinds of offices. I mean, I was on the honor roll, but I wasn't a standout athlete. I wasn't a standout academically, although, I was on the honor roll. But
you were selling, you could just hang out and we'll listen into Japanese.
Whatever.
Bing, 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 bing.
Would you rather be doing that or being in geometry too?
You got my vote.
Of course. So, and also too, you know, like I say, I mean, humor, as you know, better than anyone, is a great equalizer. You can really disarm a lot of potential opponents if you can make them laugh. And that was something I did. So
the driving the USO people interests me. I mean, was that a part of the early pixie dust of show business?
Well, see, that's interesting that you ask that question, because even though there was a sailor that drove the vehicle, you know, the minivan or whatever it was, I was a lifeguard in the summer between my junior year and senior year. And Forbes, who was the guy that was the guy that would drive the people to the airport, another hilarious character. He was nominally my boss. He wasn't there all day, but he'd come and do spot checks and he'd do the rounds and so forth. And he'd say, hey, you know, Thursday I'm going out to pick up them people that are going to be doing that MAME thing, them drama guys. I'd say, oh, can I go? So I would invite myself because, yeah, you're right. I gravitated towards any, but to me, that was professional show business. They were getting paid to do, you know, what I was doing for free and for fun. So it was fascinating to me. I mean, because really, when I watch movies and cartoons, I really didn't know how they were made or where they were made. I guess if I really thought about it, yeah, it was somewhere in Hollywood or whatever. But it wasn't until I saw a touring company of... The subject was Roses with Jack Albertson and Martin Sheen. And it really changed my life because not only did it impress me, you know, as a dramatic piece, it was so well done, but they were real people. I said, to me, now I can make the connection that you can go to your job and get paid to do this play. And I lived to do plays. I mean, to me, the classes were just in the way of getting to rehearsal at 4 o'clock, and I take the late bus home or whatever it was. Even before I was getting parts, in Virginia, I was in a couple of things. But in the shows, even when they were double cast, if I didn't get into the show, then I'd be in tickets or I'd be on props or I'd be set decoration or whatever. Because being around the show, that's good enough for me. That was a big revelation to me, because by the time I got to my senior year in Japan, I'd already done a year of plays. I got to direct a one act that was being entered into the drama competition, and I got such satisfaction out of being in that process. But it taught me I don't have to take the bow at the end of the show to get that part of me fulfilled. Mm-hmm. That the thing that I like about it. In fact, I almost liked it better. Because you had power, you were really in there affecting the way the show came out. And in a way, I sometimes wish I'd gravitated more towards directing than performing.
Did you direct after that?
Well, I have since. I mean, even mm-hmm. now, I've directed video games and some animation. I directed Comic Book the Movie, which was a direct-to-DVD that Miramax released. And I'm trying to get this made. I'm trying to get Black Pearl made, which I know for people that are watching this, they're saying, geez, you've been trying to do that for 10 years. Well, yeah, I have. And I've come so close even recently, we had backers in England. To make a long story short, they weren't able to raise the money and they fell out. Not before they brought me to Cannes and I announced, not that I want to do this movie, that I am doing this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, totally shredded my credibility. Which for the umpteenth time, and you want to get to a point. I mean, I've reached points where I said, I don't want this to become like Fulton's Folly, where I'm just a joke because I've been trying to get this one thing made for so long. But again, I still believe in it. It's a great script. I co-wrote it with the guys that got Oscar nominations for writing The Fighter.
Well, also, I think people in the industry know, as you know, Mark, that people underestimate the time that it takes to get a project
Absolutely.
Done. That there are scads and scads of wonderful projects that took literally 15 years to get onto the set.
I remember Richard Thomas got the part, but I was up for Red Sky in the morning, or Red Sky at dawn, whatever it was called. This is when I was back. I was, you know, maybe 21 or something. And I said, this is such a good script. And my agent said, yeah, it's so good that James Dean was going to do it. I said, it's been around that long? Now, this was only like 71, 72, but that means that it was actively in development in the 54, 55
sure.
range.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a shocker. And one thing about Black Pearl is it's so idiosyncratic. In other words, I said, if we're going to be an independent film, let's be defiantly independent. In other words, we can't out Bruckheimer. It's not going to lead to big helicopter chases with motorcycles flying off of buildings and landing on the cockpit of the helicopters. Let's make it cerebral thrills, like Usual Suspects. In other words, mm-hmm. a plot line that's engaging, but you don't know where the hell it's going to go. That's one of the things I love about my favorite movies are movies where you can't guess, like Fargo. I had no idea where that thing was going to go. And yet it was – because my kids came home. They saw it first. I said, how was the movie? And they said, oh, it's good. I said, well, what's it about? He goes, it's a kidnapping plot that goes wrong. And I thought, well, I've seen that on Street to San Francisco. It didn't make me say, ooh, I've got to see that movie. Right. So when I eventually saw it, it just blew my mind. I said, you guys, yeah, it's a kidnapping plot that goes wrong. But the characters and the – just all of it, just the where it was set, the environment it was in, the pregnant sheriff. I mean, it just – another movie that surprised me, and it's funny because my wife, she loves certain movies where you go, that's one of your girlfriend's dates. I mean, I don't want to see with the Meryl Streep, Sally Field in, you know, Dying Daughter. Or whatever it is, I think there's certain things where she won't go see, you know, Aliens versus Predator or some trashy
of course.
Horror film. So one of the reasons I think we've had such longevity in our marriage, it's like 3 minutes to 10, and she silently goes out to watch Grey's Anatomy in another part of the building so I can watch Beavis and Butthead. But you know what I mean? We have our areas.
You're just admitting we're different people.
Exactly.
We watch different things.
Now, there's
things.
Overlap. There's things that we both want to see, but obviously, like any of the superhero movies and so forth, I bring the boys, and she goes, no, I don't really need to see, you know, Superman Returns, which shocks me, you know. How could you not want to see Superman Returns?
Yes, honey, they're making a new Expendables.
Yeah.
Can't you wrap it around your head?
She said to me one time, you know, you ought to look at this guy, Patrick Wilson. He's a really good actor, and he might be right for Black Pearl. And I said, oh, okay. She had seen it at the movies. And I said, what's it about? She goes, oh, it's about an affair. It was another one I considered a chick flick. But she wanted me to watch it for the actor. So I got the disc. It was out of the theaters already. It was months old or you know, already been on, you know, on home video or whatever it was. And I put on Little Children. That was the one with Jackie Earle Haley as the child molester. And it was the woman from Titanic, Kate Winslet.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
She has an affair with Patrick Wilson. All I'm saying was, maybe it was because I had no expectation of being interested at all other than wanting to look at this actor. Again, a revelation. I had no idea where it was going to go. The subplot with the paroled child molester, it was so poignant. And the suspense they wrung out of somebody having an affair. Now, you're predisposed to not like someone that's having an affair. And that's another thing. I love when people can change your sensibilities, you know, like Dirty Harry was a really right-wing sort of law and order, shoot first and ask questions later, which is, you know, you'd think would be anathema to my political views, and yet Don Siegel was able to make you go, yes, you know, shoot that mofo, you know? And I love that, when they're able to make you suspend disbelief and completely turn yourself over to whatever the narrative is. And with Little Children, again, I just thought, this is a fantastic film, and it was largely because a lot of times, and I'm sure you know yourself, by page three, you go, okay, he's going to die.
You see the entire – exactly. You see, you could call off the scenes as they happen.
Of course, and that brings us full circle to Black Pearl, because I said, look, since we can't out Bruckheimer, let's make it one of those movies where once he makes this decision to go out into the world and try to do what only works out well in comic books, putting on a mask, going out into the world, trying to exact his own justice, let's hold it to the absolute scrutiny of real life, why there can't be a Batman. So it's set in the real world, and much like Fargo, where he makes one terrible decision that makes his life become unraveled, the fun will be in surprising the audience with what happens. And we were able to do that. Now, ironically enough, when it was a script first, it got into the hands of Dark Horse. They wanted to make it a comic book. And I said to my writing partner, Eric Johnson, who's also my first cousin, his dad and my mother, brother and sister. And when we grew up together, my older brother is 6 years older than me. So he's 13 days older than me. We had more of a relationship really in sync with the same kind of things. You know, we both like Popeye and Cocoa Puffs. And my older brother seemed so grown up to me. And he's a non-comic book guy. And I said because when he read, I wrote up to the point where he becomes the Black Pearl, but then I thought, I don't know where it goes from here. I want to see where it brings us under the rule of it has to be what would happen in real life, which is if you go out and exact your own justice, even if it's a good thing and you really take out, you know, Charles Manson, you're still going to be sought after by the police because we can't have vigilante justice. That was the only rule. And he said, I want in on this. He was working on something else, and I thought, I should do this myself. But it was too appealing to me to work with somebody whose company I enjoy so much. So Eric and I wrote a script. It got into the hands of Dark Horse. They wanted to make it a comic book. They wanted to just buy it and then have their guys do it. So there were two things. I said, if we're going to do this, we want to write the comic book. Well, you have no experience writing comic books. I sure have a lot of experience reading them. So, and just the idea of how do you write a comic book? What does a script to a comic book look like? Mm-hmm. But I said to Eric, you know what's ironic is it's the opposite of what we are trying to achieve in the movie. In other words, if you're trying to hold up the comic book mythology to and you know, under the harsh glare of reality in a comic book with word balloons, you just can't do it. And comic books demand something different than what a movie would. So we kept the same premise. We did five issues, which eventually were, you know, collected up into one graphic novel. But we had to make it a comic book. In other words, you had to lead to page 22 where there's a cliffhanger of some sort mm-hmm. that makes you right. want to buy the next issue and so forth. And since you can have them draw whatever you can dream up, it's not like trying to write a movie where you want to keep budget involved. In mm-hmm. other words, at one point he goes to a rally at the beach where there's 20,000 people and a riot erupts. Now, as a second-time director, the last thing I would ever want to do would be a scene of that magnitude.
Of course.
You know, I would be much more gravitated towards like a piece where like two of us are just sitting there talking. But sky's the limit. Let's do whatever we want to do. One thing that's interesting about this, and I never would have – I would have done much better, I think, if I'd known that this could happen. But when we got to the graphic novel, they said, well, you have six pages of extra pages that are going to be in the graphic novel when they're all collected together. So we can do a cover gallery, and they did. They did a cover gallery. But they said, you have these other pages to fill up, but the problem is – there's nothing in the budget. In other words, we can't give you any money for the artist. You guys are the writers. They suggested do Luther, that's the main character's name, Luther Drake, do his diary, because that could be just written and you could put it on facsimile notebook paper. And then Mike realized that I was drawing every page and sending it to the artist. So it's 22 pages per issue. What is that? Five issues, 110 pages. That I wrote on three-ring, you know, school binder paper. Exactly. And he said, oh, you ought to print that. And Eric said, oh, that's a good idea. I said, you guys, I'm not that great an artist. What I was trying to do was I saw it in my head, and some artists don't like that. They want to just hear the description, and they'll do it themselves. Other artists, in this case, we were lucky. He lived in Bosnia-Herzegovina, so, I mean, it wasn't like we were going over to his house. What he said to us through a translator was, it would make my job a lot easier if you
sort
want
of storyboarding.
To do that, of course. And, you know, that's fine with me. I'm work for hire. You know, you want to do it, do it. So I did, and it's, again, I did these, and you can see the lines. You can see the three-ring binder. But if you turn to the page that it relates to, you can see how closely he followed my description, which I loved. I mean, not that I'm a control freak, but I love the fact that I could be as involved or as distant from the final. Well, here it is. Look. He's sliding down a wire. A dog jumps up and bites his cape, and boom, he falls out of frame.
Uh-huh.
And there it is, sliding on the
your
wire.
Your drawing of the
dog jumps up, and boing, he's out. So
he's really close.
Even to the insert of him stepping on his cape, that's there.
Mm-hmm.
I think in this sequence, he might have consolidated one tier and made it. He simplified in one case. But like yesterday, I was back at it, pitching this at a movie company, and I always raise that as a reason not to fear me as a neophyte director, because I'm of the Alfred Hitchcock school of I'm not going to be on set going, I wonder where I'm going to put the camera today. Things will be so storyboarded and so finished that all I'm doing on set is executing a shot list.
Sure, of course.
And being available to the actors. I love actors. I've been there. I've done that. I understand their problems. I know they're very different. Some people want to stay in character. Some people, you know, we talked about Malcolm McDowell can just joke around, and then when the cameras turn, he's right on the money. But I totally empathize with them. In fact, it was a major revelation to me, because when I first started writing this, I was writing it for myself. I was writing, I'm going to play the Black Pearl. And it was only in that process where I said, you know, it would be much better than me. Anybody. No. But this guy or that guy would be so much better. And again, that was a revelation to myself, because I put ego aside and thought, I would much rather control the destiny of how this comes out than being Mark Hamill is the Black Pearl. It's funny. I would get notes when I did Broadway saying, must you rush your curtain call? Because at the end of a show, I'd come out and then back in the line. They said, you know, take your time, take a beat, acknowledge the house and bow. And I realized that's the hardest part for me when I'm doing a live theater piece. When the curtain goes up, you know the audience is there, but your job is to have enough concentration so that you make them feel like they're observing you and that they're not there, which works for me. The hardest part is coming out and actually and
saying you're there,
acknowledging them, yes, and then bowing.
So is the quick bow just an avoidance of maybe, I hope they don't get up and start leaving or something. Yeah, I better get out of here and take a quick bow.
It's probably rooted in that. It's probably rooted in the fact that it's a moment of self-aggrandizement, like, wasn't I wonderful?
At the end of the dresser, right?
Yes.
Let them see you coming.
I love all those. I love movies about show business in general. So, because I totally relate to that. I mean,
so really, why do you think what is the quick bow is an embarrassment of I've just opened a little of my heart in this artistic piece, and I just hope you like it. But in case you didn't, I'm getting out of here.
It's also probably a sense of minimalizing the ego part of acting. In other words, if I just make it less of a big moment, it's like, hey, thanks a lot, instead of a whole thing. I don't know.
I'm just reacting to it because I think I'm the same way, and I think I do it in a different way than you, in that I almost do it comically, you know, comically self-aggrandizing,
okay, now that works
saying
too.
Saying that thing,
that's
like,
very funny.
This is the great moment of the great star that they see. I hope that you see that I'm kidding with
yes.
this, because we all know it's just
well,
me
but
up
also
here.
But by the time you come to that moment, especially when you're doing stand-up, the audience gets a sense of your take, in other words, the best comedians, whether it's Jack Benny being cheap and vain about his age or whatever, most comedians, you know where they're coming from. So you're predisposed to accept their sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And you are so, well, there's a cynicism to your humor. There's a kind of a sarcastic edge, you know. One thing I think about stand-up comedians, and the story that illustrates it best in terms of the how brave I think stand-up comedians are, is that there's a I don't know if it's apocryphal or true, but there's supposedly there was an actor doing Hamlet, and he was just terrible. And as he goes on, the audience sort of getting, you know, shifting in their seats, and it progresses to where they're like paging through their programs and coughing and not paying attention, and you know, it progresses to the point where he's getting hooted and catcalls, and in frustration he turns to the audience and goes, "Well, what do you want? I didn't write this shit." Right. And to me, I thought, that's so funny, because he said he's blaming Shakespeare for the material. And we always have that. We can fall back on the fact was, well, it's the writing. Mm-hmm. With a stand-up comedian, there's no safety net. You either make them laugh or you don't make them laugh, and it's all you. And one of the things I think about a performer that I admire about musicians, I need a play, I need a director, I need a cast, I need all of these things. Somebody who plays guitar or somebody who does stand-up, you know, you need a light on yourself, and that's it. So there's no more fearless kind of performer, in my view, than a comedian. And I know that because I've hosted a couple of, you know, comedy showcases where you're just coming out and announcing the next comedian and so forth. And to see that life of where they're, you know, doing – going out on the road and doing these dates – staying in motels, probably trying to sleep if you can till 2 p.m. because your workday starts at 9 p.m. and finishes at 2 a.m.
Right.
If you're doing two shows. What a life. Not only do you have to be so committed, you have to have sort of the epidermis of a rhinoceros, because fate tells you that you're going to be in Paducah, Iowa, and people are just not going to get you if you're not on a sitcom, if you're not somebody that has a hit CD out or whatever. It's brutal. And so I can't tell you how much I admire stand-up comedians, because, you know, there were times when I fancied myself saying, well, I'm pretty funny. I'd like to do that.
I mean, I remember that from years ago, that you have quite a knowledge of the stand-up community,
yes,
of the various performers. You've, yes, really paid attention.
I still do. I mean, back in the days when we were working, we still had, like, Evening at the Improv. And, because, you know, I grew up when I was a little kid. You had Ed Sullivan. You knew who Robert Klein was. Mm-hmm. You knew who Stanley Myron Handelman was, or even Myron Cohen, the guy that told, right, all those Yiddish stories. I've always loved stand-up comedians. I mean, even the ones that don't really make me laugh, I'm fascinated by. Red Skelton never really made me laugh. But when he performed, I would watch him because, you know, I mean, he was doing something that fascinated me. I idolized Bill Cosby, his early albums. I loved Richard Pryor. I mean, way before he got so political and did the angry black material, when he was on Ed Sullivan, he'd be doing like a third grade production of Rumpelstiltskin, mm-hmm, as a little child, and he could be that mumble still skin, you know, and deep, and looking off. And I mean, hilarious. I mean, on Ed Sullivan, the thing I looked forward to most were the comedians, the rock and roll acts, and when they would do scenes or, you know, portions of Broadway shows, because I couldn't see Broadway. And you'd see, oh my gosh, you know, look at that show. Look at Fiddler on the Roof. Right? Well, what's that? And it's a shame. It's funny. I just bought the 3-disc set of all the Rolling Stones appearances on the Ed Sullivan show. They did it with the Beatles, too. But the reason I recommend this particular set, because like my friend Griffin was mentioning earlier, he's into opera and he's a musician. He scores. He did the only musical I ever did on Broadway. But he likes the Stones. He wouldn't buy the set. But I said, wait a second. It's the entire show plus commercials. I mean, they didn't take anything out.
Really?
Because normally, you know, it'd be just the performances of the Stones. No, it's,
but now
Tony,
it's got
Fields,
Truman Capote or whomever.
And Topo Gigio. Yeah. They have a tap dancer named Peg Leg. So, and yes, he's got one wooden peg and he's a tap dancer.
That is worth buying.
Oh my God. But see, my kids' mouths are hanging open because they never seen vaudeville on television in this pure form, where one moment it's, you know, somebody from the Metropolitan Opera singing, and then it's the Romanian folk dance troupe.
Sure.
And then it's
Ukrainian kids with the teeter board.
Oh,
you know,
yes, and spinning plates, and then, you know, a scene from Sweet Charity, and then we have a scene, you know, from, or just the wide range of material. You know, Leslie Uggams followed by, you know, whoever. So over the Thanksgiving, we always have to have some theme for what we're going to watch that day. And on Thanksgiving, it was all the Ed Sullivan shows. It's too bad in a way, because now I guess the only venue for that is Vegas.
I mean, to see an act like
where
that.
Where does a ventriloquist get work? He's not going to get it on network TV. I mean, maybe there's some cable shows I'm unaware of, but for the most part, you know,
well, those kind of acts, I think, are done. I went to years and years ago. I was with a bunch of young comedians, and we went to see the Smothers Brothers.
Right.
And we were all young, and right. We were all
cynical.
So ironic. We were just cynical, everything. Yeah. But I was so thrilled to see the Smothers Brothers.
Well, and because their act is fantastic.
They're unbelievable.
Yes.
And they're just great guys. And, but one of the Eastern European teeterboard families was opening for them.
Uh-oh.
So we're the young comics, and we're not going to make freely fun of the Smothers Brothers, but we're looking at each other going, oh, here comes Yorgi with the teeterboard. Wow. Get ready for this.
It's circus folk.
We gave them the longest standing ovation that, you know, that I've ever given anyone by the end of it. So we're sort of, oh, boy, look at this lady's outfit. Boing, she bounces like 40 feet into the air and lands on her uncle's shoulders. And just the little kid is like 6 years old. He goes, I can't describe how tall. He almost hit the ceiling of the theater and lands on, you know, uncle.
And it's generational. The grandparents were in it, then the parents, and then this.
And there's six people in a row with Uncle Kopeck at the bottom holding everybody. And
you know, what kind of life is that?
Right. But we absolutely went crazy. Yeah. It was like the greatest act we'd ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what they did. That is all they did.
And what were they going to do the night after you saw them? I mean, they get on a bus and go to wherever in Ohio to some little nightclub. I mean, it's a life that I, when I was doing Star Wars, the two little people that were, you know, C-3PO, and they had an act called the Minitones, and they played instruments and did you know, Tumblr humor back and forth. The taller one would make short jokes to the shorter one. And I was fascinated by this because, you know, the crew told me, they say, you know who they are. You know, they're the Minitones. They've been on Malcolm and Wise. They've been on Opportunity Knocks. They've been on. So they had a career besides.
So they wore the suits, the outfits by day. At night, they were going out and doing gigs?
Well, they do weekends doing gigs.
Okay.
In other words, they want to wrap early on Friday because they had two shows at two different venues on a Friday night. Two different shows on a Saturday night, and sometimes if they could wedge it in, there'd be an afternoon show like at a family club on Sundays, because they still have what they called, I forget, some variation of family club where there's pool tables and the parents can booze it up, but there's also areas for the kids to play and have games and so forth, and then there would be a show. Now, they said they would alter their show. When they were doing shows for just adults, it could be a little racier, but when they did the family clubs, it was all G-rated. And what I thought was, I said, I would love to experience that. Is there any way I could travel with you guys just for the weekend? And I just want to blend in. And they said, well, yeah, you could do that. But if you really want to blend in, because I said, I want to be just like your roadies. I'll carry your stuff. And I want to be backstage. I want to experience what that's like. They said, yeah, you can do that. Don't let them know you're a Yank. Just, you know, keep quiet, you know. So if you really want to get the full experience. Because if you're an outsider, they'll probably treat you differently. So I did that. I went with them and did, I did the two on Friday, the two on Saturday, and the afternoon. It was like a 4 o'clock show on a Sunday. And they were going back to work like I was the next Monday. And again, I think that the variety circuit in England lasted a lot longer than ours did. You know, they had more shows that were on the air that were, you know, Sunday night at the Palladium was like their Ed Sullivan show. Opportunity Knocks. There were a lot of variety-oriented shows, just like radio drama lasted much longer and still exists to a certain extent, although it's lessening and lessening. But they had soap operas, they do Shakespeare, they do Sherlock Holmes, radio plays. And big, you know, Alec Guinness would go do one. Because in England, there's much less of a caste system where the person goes, well, I don't do TV, you know, I just do features or whatever. There, it's much more, you're an actor.
You're just working.
You're working. It doesn't matter whether you're doing a BBC play that's on Sunday afternoon, and then you're doing a big James Bond film, and then you're going to go back and do a little independent film, then you're going to go to the West End and do a play, or even regional theater, you know? Mm-hmm. I just worked with a director in England who just asked me, and I thought, well, it's tempting. I don't know what the practicality of it was. He says, we've done A Christmas Carol every year. It's like in Manchester. It's not even in the West End. Would you consider playing Scrooge? Now, I'm so flattered because I love doing character parts, you know, like the sushi girl. I thought, just the fact that someone asked me to play Scrooge, I did it once for Mark and Brian on the radio, and it took me 3 versions to get up to Scrooge. In the first year I did, I was one of the guys that asked for a donation from Scrooge. Are there no workhouses? You know, that speech where he blows them off. And then I was Jacob Marley the second time I did it. Then the third time they let me do Scrooge. I love radio drama because you're not, and that's why I love voiceover. You're not constricted to how people perceive you physically. So you don't have that sense of, the anxiety of how I look, how I stand, how's my hair, how's my shirt. Even now, I didn't know until I sat down to do this that you didn't have a camera. I thought a podcast, maybe it's a video podcast. That's why I went in and I put on what
you
thought,
look really good.
Well, thank you. I was going to, and young. I look really young.
Very young, very athletic, trim, fit.
No, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, you probably get a lot more relaxed interviews because it's just sitting here chatting.
Well, I think it's just chatting. Exactly.
And I love that. And, you know, one time I went on a radio show one time. It was Tom Snyder. And he was amazed at how, you know, because sometimes he gets these people who go, answers. And he just was amazed that, you know, because we had call in and it was all this stuff. What happened was I was on, you know, people didn't know this. You know, he was on a radio show that was, I think, a 3 or 4 hour block. He'd do the first 2 hours, have his assistant take over for the third hour, go upstairs and do the Tomorrow Show CBS Television City, and then come back and finish his radio show. So his sidekick would be with him the whole 4 hours, but do that third hour. And I could be getting it wrong. Maybe it was just 3 hours. But my point is, his guy had a flat tire coming in from Malibu. And in one of the breaks, he said, will you take the show for the third hour? I said, can I?
He said to you.
Yes. And I said, oh, what an honor, you know, because, you know, he was the guy in terms of just being Mr. No Dead Air. There's not a time where he would have a moment of silence on the show. So, and again, I had great confidence because you're so in sync with the call-in guy. And it wasn't a political show. You didn't have to really get into any of that stuff. It was just a generalized chat show. So I loved it. Well, somebody heard that and invited me, and it was a year or two later. It wasn't like it happened right on top of each other. There was a guy who had, of all things, a car show. That's what they talked about, cars. And he said, come in and do the show. I said, you know, I am such a fraud. I mean, when people ask me what kind of car I drive, I say blue. I have no idea. That's just not on my radar screen of you know, it's not – it's not something I care about. I mean, if it's a good car, it's a good car. But if that's what you want, he says, oh, yeah, because it's the 20th anniversary of Corvette Summer, you know. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. And again, I don't know what they expect. I guess that if you just show up and you're just not a moron, they're impressed that you're so facile. You know, you seem to be able to handle whatever comes your way.
And it's not over yet. Yes, I did a couple of more
segments of my interview with Mark Hamill. So keep listening because they're coming up. Thanks, thanks to everybody who's listened to so many of the podcasts and sent me emails or messages on Twitter, Facebook. I appreciate it very much. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing, and thanks to Chris and Katie at Nerdist for everything. Thanks to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for helping me out on my live show. But as always, thanks to you. I'm sort of amazed and humbled at the reactions I'm getting about the podcast, and I appreciate it very much. And ask you as always, hey, tell a friend, would you? Or consider subscribing, and we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.